Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a critical look at how Americans have viewed and treated its indigenous people from a scholar who has long argued for a revised retelling of the history between the U.S. government and its native population. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, a native Oklahoman, is a historian, writer, and activist in the Indigenous Peoples Movement. Her latest book is a follow-up to her American Book Award-winning history, An Indigenous Peoples History of the United States, a revisioned history in the spirit of Howard Zinn's A Peoples History of the United States. Her new book is titled All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans, which aims to correct what the author says are Americans' inaccurate and distorted knowledge of Native peoples. From Columbus discovered America and Europeans brought civilization to Indians to current issues like sports mascots honor Native Americans, or two opposing myths. Most Indians are on government welfare and Indian casinos make them all rich. Dunbar-Ortiz and her co-author Dina Giglio-Whitaker deconstruct these statements to demonstrate how Native Americans are still marginalized today and politically ignored. Dunbar-Ortiz will be speaking Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Circle Cinema in a BookSmart Tulsa event, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for inviting me.
This book really tackles a lot of, well, they're myths about American Indians, Native Americans. What propelled you to write about the myths most Americans have about our indigenous people?
Well, you know, it wasn't really my idea. I'm always talking about the myths. And 2 years ago, I published an Indigenous People's History of the United States with Beacon Press. And they asked me to write this book as a part of their myth-busting series. So they set up the template of 21 myths, and two other books have been published in that series. So it was, I have a co-author. It's a different kind of book in that you can, each myth is autonomous. You don't have to read the book in order necessarily, but there is also a historical timeline. So we had in mind both a Native and non-Native audience and, you know, an array of age groups from at least middle school to no education, no college education or PhDs that be very useful in classrooms or for teachers to pick and choose things according to, you know, their lesson plans. And I think it's a very effective book. It was very hard to reduce the myths about Native Americans to 21. You know, we really needed 21,000, but that was the hardest part. But we tried to focus in. We do tell a lot of history in the, you know, in the context of dealing with these myths. So it's another way of changing the narrative, you know, questioning the ongoing narrative about Native Americans and about the United States.
I want to talk about the last myth in the book first. Myth 21, Indians are victims and deserve our sympathy. This gets into really at the heart of a lot of the myths that are in the book, that mm-hmm. somehow indigenous people are less than the rest of America, so that they are deserving of sympathy. And yet, as we see even today in the Dakotas, indigenous people are standing up. They're starting to flex their political muscles. I guess maybe that's the best way to put it. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that idea? Because that idea that somehow Indians are less than other Americans permeates a lot of the myths in this book.
Yeah, and that's related to our titular myth of all the real Indians died off. You know, so here are just these hapless victims that are left in their misery on reservations or and can be ignored or just feel guilty, you know, a little bit of guilt for it. But I think it avoids then looking at how have Native people survived. They have not survived by being allowing themselves to think of themselves as simply victims. They have persevered. They've retained a really, really substantial parts of their cultures that, you know, can also be adapted to the present day, their spiritualism, their ceremonies. their ways of relating to each other, mutual assistance, and, you know, just a collective sense of taking care of each other, so different from the United States individualism and dog eat dog and, you know, make a fortune. And so there are so many admirable qualities that could, if they were understood by other Americans, it could really offer a different value system, you know, a different way of living. And people who get close to Native people understand that, you know, and it really transforms them. So I think it's wonderful to have the spotlight now. These struggles are going on all the time. There's an encampment up in British Columbia that's been there 7 years. They're blocking a building of a pipeline there, and through the cold winters, everything, they have been preventing it, preventing the bulldozers from coming in. And it would take literally killing them, you know, to get them to leave. And I think that's what we have here, is this determination to take a stand, and that it's for everyone's good. It's not, you know, just a very provincial Native thing. It has to do with the whole, you know, last week is a huge explosion of a pipeline in Alabama. And it happens all the time. You know, they are not safe. As we know, I grew up in Oklahoma. There were always pipelines exploding, you know, and just the pollution in the air. And, you know, I thought it was normal growing up there. I thought the air was supposed to smell like oil. And when I finally got out of Oklahoma, I said, it smells different out here. we just live with it. And I became an asthmatic, you know. I mean, it really takes a toll on children and elderly people. And of course, you know, the earthquakes now, there's so many warnings going on. I think Native people are very attuned to the environment, you know, and have this historical, traditional sense that they are stewards of the earth, you know, not, the earth isn't their nature for them simply to exploit it. They take what is needed and use it, but it has to be respected. So they really, you know, feel a very urgent sense, and have for some time, you know, really started the environmental movement. People don't really know that it was the Hopi elders who went to the first Stockholm Conference on the Environment in 1972 and came back and really began a grassroots, not like Sierra Club, wilderness protection, you know, that kind of thing for hiking and skiing for rich people, but really deep ecology. So I think the idea of victimization is something that in the United States is by definition a negative, because as, you know, Trump the candidate is saying, he's coming out and saying it, that if you're not a winner, you're a loser. And losers, you know, are even those who get captured in war are losers.
Right.
POWs are losers. And, you know, he exaggerates, but that's really more or less he's reflecting back what the, you know, what how people really think and relate to each other. Some people are repulsed by it, but obviously about 40% of the people are very attracted to it.
Earlier you were reflecting on the last myth and reflecting it back to the first myth, which is all the real Indians have died off. And you said, you know, this goes into one of the most pervasive myths in how American is related to its indigenous people, especially since about the middle of the 19th century, especially, and that is the vanishing Indian.
Right.
And there was a reason for that.
Yeah.
If the Indian was vanishing, then the lands don't matter to the Indian.
Yeah, it's a kind of an excuse for simply taking the land. We have that mythology that was created in the 1830s by James Fenimore Cooper, the last of the Mohicans being the best known of his fictional books. But already he has the Vanishing Indian, and that takes place before U.S. independence, during the French and Indian War, where you have the Indian handing over the land to the adopted white son, and saying, we are disappearing, we are no more, and here, it's yours, you must now take care of it, you know. And that was That's been made into a movie three different times, the last time in 1992, a blockbuster. And so that mythology is just very strong. It actually goes back to the beginning, not just the 19th century. It goes, of course, this was created in the 1820s about another time, which wasn't true at all. You know, Native people were still the vast majority of the population in 1750 during the French and Indian War. So then we have the turn of the century with the, you know, this utter devastation across the continent of really genocidal, a century of genocidal campaigns and forcing all the Native people east of the Mississippi into Oklahoma, into Indian Territory, Oklahoma, and then turning, you know, during the Civil War and after the Civil War, turning to conquest of all the Plains people, the people in the Southwest, taking, you know, just a steamroller of a very industrialized military, and the defenders being, you know, about like the defenders we see today. So these are called Indian Wars, but they were basically counterinsurgent, devastating crimes against humanity, really genocide. So you have a kind of announcement after the massacre at Wounded Knee, which the Army, by the way, the U.S. Army still calls a battle and a successful battle, and they gave 30 Congressional Medals of Honor to a massacre of unarmed refugees, old men and old women and, you know, pregnant women and children, just massacred 300 or more, buried in a mass grave by the Army itself, and they have it in their annals, and everyone who goes to West Point sees that as a successful battle of the 7th Cavalry. So, you know, this is, it's not just, you know, hearsay. It's actually a part of the systematic disappearance of Native people. So then you have the End of the Trail, the famous sculpture, you know, that of the bent and half-naked Indian, you know, on his horse, also looks like it's about to die.
Yeah, bowed head.
Yeah. And then you have Ishi, the last Indian, you right. know, is that's the name of the book that came out. The Last Indian is still a bestseller. And, you know, it's this you can put that aside, you know, it says to the public, you don't have to teach about this or anything because that's, you know, all gone. And so you have a clean slate, 20th century industrialization and wealth and simply disappearance. And of course, then, you know, generations of, there was such segregation, you probably know in Oklahoma was very segregated, Indian towns, black towns, white towns, you right. know, because my father was white. I was raised in a white town, rural, these little rural towns, but there were Indian towns all around. And even the Baptists, you know, we're all raised Baptist, but there's the Indian Baptists, the black Baptists and the white Baptists. Right. Even the churches were segregated, and of course the schools. And most Indian children were sent to, forced to go to boarding school, so they weren't even in the mix. No one even got to, you know, there wasn't any social interchange even between people. So that segregation, it was pretty easy to simply not see, you know, not see Indians and feel maybe sad, you know, for some people. Some people feel triumphant, you know, we beat them, and they kind of build up this false thing of how strong these warriors were, because that makes it less genocide, you know, and more like a even playing field of war when it was really genocidal campaigns.
That's another, so the United States does not have a policy of genocide, and I thought one of the most effective arguments was you actually quote the United Nations Convention on Genocide.
Yes, yes.
And if you look at the conflicts between indigenous people and the United States through the 1800s, it's genocide is the following acts committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group.
Yeah.
Killing members of the group.
Yeah.
Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, or forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. That is American Indian policy.
Every category, yeah. And any one of those can constitute genocide, but it's all of them. it's so clear, and yet there's, you know, historians, University of Oklahoma, historian who teaches American Indian history, just, you know, published a book last year that is like this 400-page book as an argument against calling what happened genocide. He admits to horrible atrocities here and there, you know, but he calls it ethnic cleansing. And, of course, ethnic cleansing has no weight in law, international law. It's, you know, it's just a common term for genocide. I mean, that's the definition of genocide, is ethnic cleansing.
And the United States has come close. I mean, they've apologized. They've made certain statements, but they don't go to that particular. How important is that to indigenous people?
Well, you know, I think for Native people, you know, we do this work at the United Nations, too, and we got, in 2007, a Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples worldwide. It was pretty much started, that work was started by North American Native people in Canada and the United States back in the early 70s, and it sort of came out of Wounded Knee, but also the Hopi, you know, going to the Stockholm in 72, and they've been working on it a long time, and this is international law, the Genocide Treaty. So that's why it's important. It's important as a so that the word isn't just used carelessly for this and that, meaning, you know, just vast numbers of people killed. Because although that was the case with the genocide and Holocaust, when they did the treaty, they wanted to, you know, the title of it is prevention. Prevention of the crime of genocide, prevention and punishment. So prevention would, they're looking back in history at all of the pogroms against Jews in Christian Europe that go back to the, you know, in Middle Ages, to the beginning of Christianity, the Crusades and all. And this built up to a 20th century genocide. So when you see these things happening over and over, where Jews are, there are whole parts of Tsarist Russia that were literally ethnically cleansed. That's why in the early 20th century, so many Russian Jews from that area immigrated to the United States, that they were not allowed to live there. So Germany was kind of a safe place to live, you know, and then that happened. So. Yeah. They're looking at the history and what builds up to it. So it's not just after the fact punishing someone who did it, but, preventing it and creating systematic legal frameworks that make that at least minimally possible. And that's what we need to do in the United States. So the convention is very clear and very clean. You know, there's not a single word in it that could be misinterpreted. And I think that's why people don't want to talk about it, because they want to talk about genocide. Well, you know, it was germs that Indians just died off. You know, if they stood in front of a European, they, you know, caught something and just fell down dead. You know, so that's not genocide. Well, but that's not what happened. You know, people got these diseases when they were pushed off their land, had no food supply, had no facilities, often in, you know, literally in concentration camps, like the Navajos during the Civil War were driven over to a desert, you know, in the southwest New Mexico. 8,000 were herded up, and it was a concentration camp, and half of them died there of starvation and exposure. So, yeah, and probably some diseases, but, you know, that's what's happening in refugees. I've done a lot of refugee work around the world, and I understood, it's the first time I really understood, this is what Native people were when they're pushed off their land. They're refugees, and, you know, diseases just spread really fast through a refugee population because it's not the optimum. I mean, even today, with all of the hygiene and everything, and the United Nations, it still is a very dangerous situation to be in, very crowded refugee camps. So, you know, I think the way a lot of Americans and, you know, historians, they won't enter into these conversations because they sort of have their minds made up that this is how they function, and then what do they do with that knowledge? And you have to ask, what does Germany do with the knowledge of its past? They teach it. They teach it in their books. It doesn't make them any less German, or, you know, it doesn't make them any less people for, you know, starting in the first grade, learning the true history of Germany, 20th century Germany, and they pay reparations, you know. So why can't we, you know, I mean, wouldn't that make this a better society, you know, to take that responsibility and tell children the truth rather than lying to them all the time?
My guest today is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She is an author, historian, and activist in the Indigenous Peoples Movement. She is the author of All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. It's published by Beacon Press. She'll be speaking and signing her book this Sunday at the Circle Cinema that gets underway at 2 o'clock, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let me talk about a couple of myths that one is in the news, especially in our part of the country, and that is about sports mascots. Of course, we had a sports mascot in the news here, the World Series, one of the more egregious ones, at least the representation of the Cleveland baseball team. But certainly here in Oklahoma, it's still an issue in many places around the country. But the larger issue, even beyond sports mascots, is it goes into other areas. So it goes into New Age philosophy, and it's the appropriation of indigenous culture into the wider culture, where they appropriate the imagery, the beliefs, the all sorts of things about indigenous culture into the larger culture. Why is this an important issue?
Well, it also gets exported. I know the first time I went to Central America in the early 80s, they have a soda that is very nice, you know, locally made in Central America. And you look at it, and it has this little caricature of a, you know, like that caricature of Wahoo, you know, the Indian, like pretty much like the Cleveland thing. And I said, and it's called Rojas, you know, it's called the red red soda. And, you know, so it's like it gets exported with the U.S. being all over the world and the U.S. economy so dominant that it's not just here. Native people run into that everywhere they go and travel. It's that people do the war hoot, you know, blah, 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 blah to them and say, oh, that's what you are. It's like, it's very embarrassing, you know, for them when they understand that this is, you know, completely unacceptable. But here it really has come down to this tenacious hold, like the Washington team and the Cleveland Indians and the Atlanta Braves. They're still doing their tomahawk chop. I think there's something like 1,000 or more schools, you know, teams in high schools and private schools around the country that have these mascots and imagery. And it's so hard to explain that this is a part of the genocide, you know, because you can look back at the Nazi era and the caricatures of Jews, you know, the big hooked nose and the greedy blood coming out of the mouth and the hands like Dracula, you know. I mean, it's just really, really horrific imagery. It's very effective for either being afraid of these people, creating fear. But now it's more or less just creating a caricature of unimportant people.
How would you respond to people who would say that those sports mascots are honoring Native Americans?
Yeah, that is what sports fans will often say that. Well, no, I really admire Indian warriors and we're honoring them, and they say that in the military too. They name all their deadly equipment after with Native names, yeah. You know, and
Apache helicopters,
and all the big powerful vehicles like Cherokee, you know? and they think it's honoring because they have the stereotype of the Hollywood a Plains Indian warrior, which was never true even of the Plains Indian, as a defeated enemy. You know, it's like I consider these like war trophies that are kept and held, you know, kind of fetishes. I think of that movie, Something with a Golden Eye, with Marlon Brando, and he turns out he's a military officer, and he turns out to have all this Nazi stuff, you know, these fetishes. And that's really how I think of it. I think if people understand a fetish and how it, even the gun, you know, the whole worship of the gun in the United States, that's also a fetish, you know, it's how the West was won. And so people automatically, without any kind of instruction otherwise in education or from the bully pulpit of politicians or preachers, they go into, you know, the that world of the subconscious of being triumphant in war, and also just not admitting that this is a very warlike society from its very beginning. It was made with war. It's never had one day in its existence. I can't find one. I've been challenging people. Find me one day in U.S. history when the U.S. wasn't killing someone officially.
Really?
Yeah, because if you leave out the Indian Wars, you leave out the whole 19th century.
Right.
And then in the 20th century, they're down in Central America and in Haiti, you know, in the Philippines. They're occupying the Philippines and killing people. So there's not a day. I've never been able to get anyone to come up with a day. And some people have really searched, and they come up with possibilities. Then I look it up, and I find something. So that's important to understand what a belligerent society the United States is in. And we all internalize that. So that's why Vietnam was such a crushing blow, you know, and they stayed in there so long. It was like another Indian War, only they lost it. Those people even looked like Indians, you know. And we haven't, you know, the society hasn't recovered from that, especially not the military.
The name of the book is All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to speak with you, Britt. Thank you.
Historian, author, and Indigenous peoples activist Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The Native Oklahoman's latest book is titled All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. It's published by Beacon Press. She'll be speaking Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Circle Cinema in a Book Smart Tulsa event. That event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.